I gripped the steering wheel so hard my knuckles turned white. The vinyl was hot and sticky against my palms. It was 104 degrees in the shade, but there was no shade on Highway 83. Just miles of sun-bleached asphalt and the shimmering heat rising off the road like ghosts. My back ached with a dull, rhythmic throb that I tried to tell myself was just the seat. I was 38 weeks pregnant. I was also 2 hours into a 4-hour drive. I looked at the clock on the dashboard. It was 2:14 p.m. If the truck held together and the road construction outside of Childress didn't back up, I might make my appointment by 4. This was my life now. This was the reality of living in a county where the hospital had chained its doors 6 months ago. They said it wasn't profitable. They said the volume didn't justify the overhead. They didn't say what women like me were supposed to do when the biology of labor ignored the bottom line of a balance sheet. The air conditioning in my old Ford hummed a low, dying note. It blew lukewarm air that smelled like dust and old pennies. I rolled the window down an inch, but the wind was like a physical blow to the face. I rolled it back up. I touched my stomach. It was hard, tight as a drum. The baby kicked. A sharp, frantic movement that made me gasp. I wasn't just driving to a checkup. I was driving for my life. In this part of the country, a complication wasn't a medical emergency. It was a death sentence. I passed a rusted sign for the Memorial Hospital. Someone had spray-painted "closed" across it in jagged black letters. It used to be 20 minutes from my front door. Now the nearest NICU was 240 miles away. I thought about the math of that. I did the math every single night before I went to sleep. If my water broke at home, I had to call an ambulance that might take 40 minutes to arrive. Then that ambulance would have to drive me 4 hours to a facility equipped to handle a delivery. Most of the rural EMS crews around here were volunteers. They were good people, but they didn't have the kit for a neonatal crisis. They had oxygen and bandages. They didn't have a miracle. Another cramp bloat up in my lower back. This one felt different. It wasn't the dull ache of sitting too long. It was a slow, creeping squeeze that started at my hips and wrapped around my middle like a vice. I held my breath. I counted. 1, 2, 3, 4. It lasted 40 seconds. Then it faded, leaving me shivering despite the heat. "Not now," I whispered. My voice sounded thin and papery in the cramped cabin. "Please, not now." I checked the GPS. I was still 80 miles from the clinic. 80 miles of scrub brush and cattle guards. There wasn't a gas station for another 30. There certainly wasn't a doctor. I felt a sudden sharp surge of anger. It tasted like bile in the back of my throat. I had paid my taxes. I had worked at the grain elevator for 12 years. I had done everything right. And yet, here I was, hurtling down a highway at 75 miles an hour, praying that my body wouldn't do what it was designed to do for just a few more hours. The road blurred for a second. I blinked hard. I couldn't afford to lose focus. If I went off the shoulder, no one would find me for hours. The traffic out here was sparse, mostly cattle trucks and the occasional utility vehicle. I saw a buzzard circling high above a fence line. It felt like an omen. I reached for my water bottle in the cup holder. It was warm and tasted like plastic. I forced myself to drink. Dehydration could trigger contractions. That's what the nurse told me over the phone last week. She sounded tired. She was probably overwhelmed by the influx of women from the surrounding three counties who were all funneled into her single overcapacity clinic. She told me to stay hydrated and stay calm. She didn't tell me how to stay calm when you're driving the length of a small European country just to get your blood pressure checked. The next contraction came 10 minutes later. It was stronger. I felt the sweat break out on my forehead. My vision tunneled. I pulled over onto the shoulder. The gravel crunched under the tires, a harsh grinding sound that felt like it was happening inside my skull. I put the truck in park and leaned my head against the steering wheel. I could feel the heat soaking through the glass of the windshield. I took deep, ragged breaths. I tried to remember the breathing exercises from the online class I'd watched. It felt ridiculous now. Those classes were filmed in bright, clean rooms with yoga mats and soft music. They weren't meant for a woman sitting in a 2012 Ford F-150 on the side of a deserted highway with the temperature topping triple digits. I looked at my phone. No service. I wasn't surprised. This was one of the many dead zones that dotted the map. I was alone. Truly, terrifyingly alone. I looked at the vast, empty horizon. The sky was so big it felt like it was crushing the earth. I felt small. I felt disposable. The contraction receded. I waited. I waited for the next one. But it didn't come immediately. My heart was hammering against my ribs. I had a choice. I could turn around and try to get back to the small volunteer fire station in my town, or I could keep pushing forward. Turning back meant 4 hours of driving toward a place that couldn't help me. Moving forward meant 2 hours toward a place that could. I put the truck back in gear. I drove. I passed a small farmhouse with a collapsed roof. I remembered when a family lived there. They had kids who played in the yard. They moved out after the local pharmacy closed. It was a slow rot. First the grocery store, then the pharmacy, then the hospital. When the infrastructure goes, the people follow. Only those of us who couldn't afford to leave were left behind. We were the remnants. We were the ones who had to navigate the maternal desert. I thought about my mother. She had me in the local hospital 30 years ago. She said it was a quiet, easy day. She walked in at 10 in the morning, and I was born by 3 in the afternoon. She had a room with a window that looked out over the town square. She felt safe. I realized then that safety was a luxury I couldn't afford. At 3:10 p.m., the pain returned with a vengeance. This wasn't a squeeze. It was an explosion. I screamed. A raw animal sound that filled the truck. I felt a hot gush of fluid between my legs. My water had broken. The panic hit me like a physical wave. I was still 40 miles away. I looked at the speedometer. 80. 85. The truck began to shake. I didn't care. I couldn't stop. If I stopped, the baby was coming out on the upholstery. I gripped the wheel until my fingers felt numb. "Keep it together," I sobbed. "Just keep it together." The road began to wind. I was hitting the foothills now. The curves were sharp, and the truck leaned dangerously with every turn. My vision was swimming. I felt another contraction start. It didn't wait 10 minutes this time. It waited 5. I saw a sign, Midland 30 miles. 30 miles. 30 minutes. If I drove like a lunatic. I pushed the gas pedal to the floor. The engine roared. A desperate, straining sound. I felt the baby moving lower. The pressure was immense. It felt like I was being torn apart from the inside out. I passed a highway patrol car parked in a median. I didn't slow down. I saw the lights flash in my rearview mirror, red and blue. A part of me was relieved. Maybe he could escort me. Maybe he had a radio that worked. Maybe he knew what to do. I didn't pull over. I couldn't. I pointed out the window toward my stomach and kept driving. The siren wailed, adding to the cacophony of the engine and my own ragged breathing. The officer pulled alongside me, gesturing for me to stop. I shook my head frantically. I shouted through the glass, even though I knew he couldn't hear me. "I'm having a baby," he seemed to understand. He sped up, moving in front of me, his lights clearing the way. It gave me a small, flickering spark of hope. I followed the taillights. They were my North Star. But the body doesn't care about police escorts. The body follows its own internal clock. The contractions were coming back to back now. There was no break. No time to breathe. I felt the urge to push. It was an overwhelming, primal instinct. I tried to fight it. I tried to clench my muscles. But it was like trying to stop a tidal wave with a sandcastle. I hit the city limits. The buildings started to appear. Traffic lights. I ignored them. The officer cleared the intersections. We were minutes away. I felt the baby's head. I shrieked. A sound of pure agony and terror. I steered the truck into the ambulance bay of the hospital, following the patrol car. I didn't even put it in park. I just slammed on the brakes and the engine stalled. I slumped against the door, my legs shaking so violently I couldn't stand. The officer was there in a second. He opened the door. He saw the blood. He saw the situation. He shouted for help. Nurses came running out with a gurney. They were talking to me, asking me my name, telling me to breathe. I couldn't talk. I could only point down. They lifted me onto the gurney. The air in the hospital was cold. It felt like ice against my sweat-soaked skin. They wheeled me through the double doors, the lights on the ceiling passing by in a blur. "You're okay," a nurse said. She was young, her eyes wide with adrenaline. "You made it." But I didn't feel like I had made it. I felt like I had survived a shipwreck. I felt like I had been hunted. The delivery was fast. It was brutal. There was no time for an epidural. There was no time for a birth plan. There was only the white-hot pain and the sound of my own voice screaming until it went hoarse. When the baby finally came, he didn't cry. The room went silent. The frantic energy shifted into a heavy, suffocating stillness. I watched the doctors huddled over the small blue form on the warming table. I saw the flash of the intubation tube. I saw the rhythmic compressions of a thumb on a tiny chest. "Why isn't he crying?" I whispered. No one answered me. They were working. They were fighting for the life that had been spent 4 hours on a highway. Minutes passed. They felt like hours. I lay on the table, shivering, my body empty and broken. I looked at the clock on the wall. 4:52 p.m. Finally, a thin, weak sound broke the silence. A tiny, fluttering cry. I closed my eyes. Tears leaked out of the corners, hot and salty. They brought him to me an hour later. He was wrapped in a dozen blankets, wires trailing from his chest to a monitor. He was small, even for 38 weeks. His skin was pale. He looked exhausted. "He's stable," the doctor said. He looked at me with a mixture of pity and frustration. "But he's going to need to stay in the NICU for a while." He went through a lot of distress during that drive. I looked at my son. I thought about the 4 hours of vibration, the heat, the terror, the lack of oxygen. I thought about the fact that if I had lived 10 miles further west, he wouldn't be breathing at all. "I almost lost him," I said. The doctor sighed. He leaned against the wall. "You're the third woman this week from your county. One of them didn't make it in time. She delivered in a parking lot in Guthrie. The baby didn't survive the night." I looked at the monitor. The green line of his heartbeat flickered. It was a fragile, tenuous thing. I realized then that the success of my story was a lie. I had survived, and my son was alive, but we were both casualties. I had been forced to gamble with his life because the place I called home had been stripped of its dignity. I stayed in the hospital for 3 days. On the fourth day, they told me I could go home, but the baby had to stay. They told me I could visit him as much as I wanted. I looked at the nurse. I thought about the 4-hour drive. I thought about the gas money I didn't have. I thought about the truck that was currently sitting in the impound lot, because I'd abandoned it in the bay. "I can't," I said. My voice was flat. "I can't come back every day." The nurse looked away. She knew. She had seen this before. I walked out of the hospital alone. The sun was just as bright as it had been 3 days ago. The heat was just as oppressive. I took a bus back to the edge of the city and paid a friend of a friend $50 to drive me the rest of the way home. As we crossed the county line, I saw the closed sign again. It felt like a tombstone. I went into my house. It was quiet. The nursery I had set up was empty. The crib was a skeleton of wood and shadow. I sat on the edge of my bed and looked at my hands. They were still shaking. I had my life. I had my son. But I had lost the belief that I mattered. I lived in a desert. And in the desert, things only grow if they have the strength to fight for every drop of water. I am a mother. I am a survivor. But mostly, I am a woman who knows exactly how many miles separate a life from a tragedy. And I know that next time, the road might be just a little bit longer.